even if they don't know it. It will be there every time they look up.
My father died unexpectedly late on a Thursday night and was buried early Friday. I wore black. I did not cry. I think now because my mother was crying so much. It seemed like her energy was being drained from her. My love for my father felt small compared to my mother's. I wondered if onlookers thought I felt nothing. And, of course, after that thought entered, I could not cry in front of anyone, fearing I would be a hypocrite if I gave expression to my pain only after considering another's interpretation of it. The call for prayer sounded after the funeral. It was a beautiful and soothing recitation, even on that day, or perhaps especially on that day. For as long as it was heard, it was the only sound. Even the birds quieted, even the shopkeepers had closed their gates. My father would often look at the animals during times of prayer, and he would say, "Look how every creature knows what time it is." He would point up and say, "For him, even the birds and the sheep and the stray cats, hush. A calm blankets everything." My father was gone. I was a kind of lonely, I did not think anyone could understand. We had not been close in life, I hardly knew him. We had little in common. But every Friday for Jumma, we walked together the short distance to the mosque, and I stood by him in prayer. After, I was in charge of finding our shoes. What else connected us, if not that, and the blood in our veins? That when we heard the adhan, we went together, the two of us. I walked that Friday alone. I tucked my shoes away in a corner by themselves. The men I did not know gathering like a flock about to still, finding a spot in line. Here, everyone had a place. We stood, side by side. One man passed me a sajdaga. My father was gone. I was 13. Looking back, I was just a boy. And then the second call to prayer, the time to rise. I stood. No one around me knew I had buried my father that day. I lifted my hands, readying myself to focus on the prayer. I could not recall what it had been like to have had a father. I had already forgotten. Then the Arabic verses began, the murmuring of moving lips, the entire hall filling with whisper. We lifted our palms up together, we bent together, and we lowered our heads to the ground together. We were one unit composed of 100, all of us moving and trying to think only of God. My lips moved. I was among brothers. I was home. About 5 years ago, Hadia and Tariq got jobs an hour away in Palo Alto and moved back. They were lucky. But Leila and I felt luckiest of all. Our years of being alone, of spending entire days only occupying our room and the kitchen, were over. By then, Huda had moved to Arizona after marrying Javed, the grandson of my father's oldest friend, who had sent the proposal after they met at Hadia's wedding. Leila and I waited eagerly for Hadia to ask us to help her with the bas. He was only 3 then. Sometimes he stayed with us for entire workdays. We were getting to know him. We had flown to Chicago when he was born, but after, we had only seen him for a few days at a time. He liked spinach, pretending bites where airplanes did not work, but if we named each bite after a superhero, he would eat them. He always got full before the very last bite. He preferred rain to strong wind. I was Nana, and Leila was Nani. Leila made up stories that she had never told our own children, playful and funny tales about yellow chicks who were enemies and endlessly plotted pranks on each other, stories that made Abbas laugh and laugh.
I laughed too, if only because Abbas's laughter was a force that caught me by surprise.
Abbas fell asleep easily with Leila and went to her when he was tired or if he had hurt himself and begun to cry. But during his unhurt waking hours, it was me he wanted. My arms he was always in. It was a mark of that age. I had slept through my children's childhood. I would not allow that to happen with him. I would hold him any time he asked, even during the months that Hadia and Tariq were trying to break his bad habit of being held. Everything he did, I told myself to cherish the act, knowing that the age would pass and he would stop asking me to carry him everywhere, would stop ranking the ones he loved.
"Mama number one,"
he would announce, holding up a finger, then pressing my nose with his finger.
"Nana, number two." "And what about us?"
Leila would ask, and Tariq would ask.
"Baba and Nani, number three,"
he would say. They would feign hurt and say,
"Baba and Nani the same? Can Baba and Nani be number two, too?"
"No,"
he refused them.
"Nana, number two."
I felt for Leila, and I felt for Tariq, but I could not deny it. The enlarging of my heart when I lifted him in my arms and kissed the crown of his head. "That's right," I whispered to him. He did not know how to wink then, but he did scrunch his nose and show his two front teeth any time he knew it was mischievous to agree with me. Never mind number one. I had never been anyone's number two, and I vowed to do what I could to keep my rank.
The year Abbas turned five, the news was constantly playing in the background of our home. That was the year I realized I had stopped being surprised by what people could say. It was the easiest movement, to suddenly feel hated. It was almost as though I had known it all along. So when it came, what surprised me was not the existence of hate so much as the casual quality of it.
"Turn it off," Hadia said one night when she came to pick up Abbas and Tahira. "I want to protect them from this for as long as possible." Tahira was napping on our couch. Abbas was drawing under the coffee table. "He will not understand any of it," I assured her. She seemed uncharacteristically worried. I did my best to respect her wishes as a parent. That night, I turned the television off, but the voices did not leave my mind easily. Hadia was right. He was little, but who knew what the effect would be on him? It was 2016, and that year I watched and watched the news as though watching would do something for me. Would explain to me what was happening, would prepare me for something. But it only made me nervous and heavy of heart. I whispered to Leila that I was going for a walk. The sun had just begun to set. I kissed the top of Hadia's head in case she had left by the time I returned, and I snuck out without telling Abbas in case he tried to come along. I did not walk in the yard, but along the streets of the neighborhood we had lived in since Hadia was four and Huda was three. I still remember the day we first stepped inside as a family. Hadia was so scared when we pretended to sneak in, she had pinched her hands into little fists. Leila and I had always planned on one day moving into a smaller home, to a more affordable area, as ours was expensive because of the good schools we now had no need for. We did not know what our children's values would be, if they would be willing to live with their parents as I would have had my parents lived, and so we talked sometimes of moving into a bungalow to make it easier for us as we aged, one close to the mosque to make our commute shorter. But after you ran away, we never spoke of it again. We both knew, without ever saying it aloud, that now we would never. Sometimes, still, if there was an unexpected knock on the door, my heart would quicken for just a moment, thinking, what if? But it would only be a family friend dropping by unannounced, a volunteer asking us if we were registered to vote. As I walked that night, I waved at each of my neighbors who were out on their darkening lawns. They waved back. Had the way they thought about me changed? I did not think so. I was caught between thinking the world was changing around me and I was a changed man in it, or believing that nothing had changed, least of all my resolve to wave and smile at my neighbors. I walked and walked until the sky turned violet, and I reached the field where a horse was kept behind a wooden fence wrapped with barbed wire. The horse had a shiny dark coat and a white splotch between his eyes. Some special evenings, you three would insist on accompanying me on my walk and would ask to come here. You and Hadia liked the horses a moderate amount, but Huda had a tiny figurine of a tan horse she kept on her windowsill. She spoke to the horses in the field and named them Cow or Pinocchio, and I would tease her for it, and you would laugh and laugh. Layla would send us with a plastic bag of chopped apples, and you three would take turns tossing slices into the dirt, squealing when a horse moved to eat it, the breath from its nose disturbing the dirt. Chopped? I had asked Layla once when I glanced inside the plastic bag. What do horses care if the apple is chopped? She had smiled at me in a way that I cannot clearly picture now, as much as I try to, and she gave me that loving look of hers that says to me, "Oh, Rafiq, you have never understood, and you never will." If the apple is chopped, then the children get to feed it to the horse longer, she said, nodding to where you three waited for me at the edge of the driveway, Huda already jumping. She always thought of you three. She always thought of everything. That evening, the horse trotted to me as soon as I approached the fence. I reached out and touched the white diamond between his eyes. The horse blinked at me, and there was something gentle and almost human about him. A very dangerous anger and ignorance had been unleashed, I thought. My thoughts felt foolish and inadequate against it. I was just one man. My voice would be like shouting into the wind, only for the wind to suck it in and carry it away to nowhere. The horse kicked his hooves against the dirt, and dust rose, and all of a sudden I pictured your face from years ago, when you were in 7th grade, and I watched you approach me after you had been suspended, your eyes swollen and your white shirt stained with blood, and that blend of absolute love and complete terror I had never felt for anyone before that moment. My breath had caught in me. I had not even known I had been capable of such a reaction. I trembled. My Abbas was 5 years old. He was as confident and curious as any other child. He was about to begin his first year of kindergarten. I was his second favorite person in the world, and I was not sure what to explain to anyone in a way that would protect him. And you, wherever you were, even though I could not accurately picture your face past 23, I knew the faint scar above your eyebrow and the fainter one beneath your lip. God, I thought, it feels tonight like the forces of the world are closing in on me, the way darkness closes in to become night, slowly, and then all at once. And I do not know what I can do or say so that no one will ever think to strike my Abbas's face in the future, as my own son's face had once been struck by others, by me. The morning of the surgery, I wake mid-thought, as though I had spent my sleeping hours asking questions and attempting answers in my mind. What do I owe? Who have I wronged? The surgery will take no more than 4 hours. Hadia wheels me into a small room, and together we wait for the cue from Dr. Edwards. She tells me that as soon as I am settled with Dr. Edwards, she will join Leila and Huda in the waiting room.
You won't be needing me in there as much as Mama will, she says with a smile.
My children have been shielded from aging. I am impressed by them now, by their maturity, by their seriousness, by their consideration to care for me in ways I have not asked them to.
Are you nervous?
Hadia asks. I shake my head. The room we wait in is bare. Nothing about hospitals is designed to comfort the patient. Hadia, I begin before I realize what I am trying to say. I let my anger control me too often. She opens her mouth to interrupt me, but I raise my hand to stop her. Let me say it. I know I had a temper. I know it hurt you. Hadia is still.
And then she thanks me. Anything else you want to get off your chest?
She jokes. She takes a sip of her coffee, which battles with the disinfectant to be the strongest smell in the room. Then she reaches over and places her hand over mine.
Just focus on getting better, Baba.
She glances at her watch. When I first saw her wearing it again, years after it had gone missing, she explained its reappearance before I even asked. Still, I've wondered. Have you heard from Amar? I say it out loud, just like that. As though only a week or two has passed. As though I failed to reach you on the phone after trying a few times and thought to ask if she had had any success. Any lightness that was in the air between us a moment ago vanishes. She does what she does now that she has become self-conscious of how much her hair is grayed. She runs her hand through it as if to comb it. My heart begins thudding.
Are you feeling all right?
She asks me in Urdu.
Does he know I'm here?
I didn't expect my voice to break, but it has taken years for me to draw up courage to ask. She shakes her head, wraps both hands around her coffee, cradling it.
Do you know where he is?
Again, she shakes her head. When she finally looks at me, there is fear in her eyes.
Of what? I'm not sure. Are you in contact with him?
I ask. She sighs. I watch her as though any action of hers will give me a clue to unpack later. Her pager beeps. It is time to wheel me into the room where Dr. Edwards is waiting. But I have not taken my eyes off her.
No,
she tells me finally.
We are not.
I feel my shoulders relax. Or maybe they are sighing. Or maybe they are collapsing. Maybe they are just giving up. I was not afraid before. But now, I am afraid. Afraid that if I wake in a few hours, or do not wake, if I recover for years or just for a few more months, I will not be any closer to knowing if you are well in the world. Hathia stands. She reminds me again of the plan and procedure, and I nod along. This is the easy part. This is nothing. Before she takes the handles of the wheelchair, she kneels in front of me so we are face to face. An entire streak of her hair is gray. We have changed. Now she knows I think of you. Now she knows I wonder. I have given away the only power I had in this situation at all, the power of appearing unaffected. She seems aware of this as she studies my face, her eyes very big, copies of your mother's, ready to welcome anyone they look upon. One side of her mouth lifts into a smile, so she looks like she almost pities me. She leans forward with her index finger and begins to trace a shaky Ya Li on my forehead, as your mother would do for each of us when we were vulnerable and in need of reassurance. She means to prepare me for what I am about to face, to give me a shield of protection and strength. But instead of strength, I feel a wave of gratitude so overwhelming, I am weakened before it. And I know that I did try my best to be a father to my children. I did. And I did fail. In some instances, so completely that I do not know where my own son is, and he does not know I am here, moments away from being wheeled into my surgery. But I have also been successful. I have passed down to Hathia what I have known to be valuable, and when she pulls away her finger, I open my eyes and blink at my own hands, so helpless in my lap, unable to look up at her.
3. Today is the first day since the surgery I have to myself. Layla has been relentless in her care for me during the months of recovery. She has come along on every walk, accompanied me on every errand, interrupted any stretch of sweet silence to ask how I am, no matter how clearly Dr. Edwards and Hathia assure her that all is well. But she had been invited to a lady's jashan today, and I urged her to go. And the moment she drove away, I snuck from our home as well. The sun is setting when I turn onto Hathia Street. Soon, I will have to explain my absence, but for now, I enjoy the freedom, the familiarity of the route, and the promise of seeing my grandchildren and presenting Abbas with the gift I bought him earlier today. You would like Abbas. He looks like you. Sometimes the resemblance is so striking, I can't take my eyes off of him. It is not just his features that alarm me, but his mannerisms are also shockingly yours, though he has never met you to copy you. I know your mother realizes it too. I can tell by the way she reaches out to touch his hair, how she glances over at him when he has fallen asleep on the couch. He asks about you sometimes. He is the only one who does. He will point to photographs of you that your mother, years ago, insisted on leaving there, untouched unless to be dusted, and ask a question. Only if he and I are alone will I attempt an answer for him. He asks the kind of questions you used to ask me, odd and pointless, questions I would often be too busy for, or find too silly to answer. But I found my patience for him is boundless. When Hathia opens the door, she is surprised to find me. She glances at the box, but says nothing, invites me inside, and while Abbas and Tahira gather around me, I hear Hadia's voice from the hallway, telling someone on the phone, "He's here. Don't worry, I'll call you soon."
By the time she has come back, I have presented the box to Abbas. I tell Tahira, who sulks in my arms, that I will be back next week with one for her as well. She makes little animal noises to tell me that my promise is not enough.
Why, Baba?
Hadia asks from behind me,
her tone concerned.
His birthday was a few weeks ago. Eid is not for months.
I ignore her. I watch Abbas open the box and lift up the red shoe. And it is astonishing how he really does look just like you, with that same kind of sensitivity and consideration about him, because I can tell he does not know why I have gotten them, and does not particularly want them. But as soon as he erases the initial perplexed look, he thanks me earnestly, ties the laces tight, and runs up and down the hall. I hear the sound of his feet hitting the tile and watch the shoes light up, alternating blue and red lights spilling onto the white tile, flashing, just as you had advertised in one of your posters. Adia's quiet, even as Abbas breaks the rules of her home. When I look at her, her face is pale. She turns from me and gathers the tissue papers and returns them gently to the box, closes the lid.
Mama's worried. Go home,
she says, running her hand across the cardboard surface of the box, her back to me.
Do you like them, Mama?
Abbas asks her when he runs back into the room. Hadia nods at him, her lips pressed into a straight line in a look that awes me. How like Layla she has become. Abbas looks from me to Hadia, searching for an explanation as to why his mother seems upset. Later, Hadia walks me to my car, her hands in her back pockets. I can tell she is restraining herself on purpose, not wanting to hurt me or offend me.
He will like them, I tell her.
I want her to speak. I want her to say anything. It doesn't matter what.
What good does it do now, Baba?
She says softly. I drive home, thinking of Hadia and wondering, for the first time, if it was not just you who had been affected by my refusals, but she, too. One thing I never told your mother was how secretly impressed I was by the way you had organized the campaign for the shoes. I remember the little facts and drawings you included on the posters. With such determination you decided to go against my initial refusal, with such creative effort. Of course I could not allow you to see that. But Hadia's right. It doesn't do any good now. Amar, I had thought that denying you would build character. I thought the not having would teach you something valuable. You were always so sensitive, and your mother, out of love for you or seeking to protect you, would give you anything you wanted. I was afraid you would grow up spoiled. I especially didn't want it to be material goods that we spoiled you with. But when you stood before dinner and pulled a sheet of folded binder paper from your pocket and asked permission to deliver a speech, I allowed it. And you had done such a wonderful job constructing your argument. It was well thought out and persuasive, even though I knew that you had failed horribly on your persuasive essay assignment. When we struck our deal, when you met my eyes as we shook hands to make our agreement official, I saw the focus, the dedication, what you were capable of. That night, I told myself that I would allow you the shoes even if you got 90%, 80%. I thought of how I would explain it to you. You got the shoes because you tried. Because you worked harder than you had been working.
Your mother was kinder to me that week.
Though she never said as much, I could tell she felt more tenderness. Sometimes I have wondered if she only gave me love when I gave you three love. That without the three of you to care for and raise, she and I would have had little between us. And that when you left, the part of her that loved me began to dwell in our loss of you instead. But I know it is unfair of me to say this, to even think it. I wanted you to have the shoes, Amar. I want you to know that. You were so proud when you presented your test to me, and we decided we would go to the mall that weekend. You may have hugged me, I don't know. And I felt, for the first time in a long time, that I did know how to be a father to you. That you had shown me how capable you were of working hard, of keeping your word. That maybe what worked for Hadia and Hudda would not work for you. That I could meet you where you insisted on standing, without appearing to compromise. We could find some solution, the two of us. But that night, while you slept, I heard a knock at my office door. It was Hadia. I lifted my face from my papers and invited her inside. She was hesitating with me in a way that I had not noticed before, and I pressured her, perhaps too sternly, when I should have let her keep her secret. A secret.
Amar cheated, she said. It's on the bottom of his shoe.
To my surprise, I felt a deep disappointment, not with you, but with her. I had found comfort in knowing my children had obvious ties to one another. Even in the way you and your sisters fought, there was love. And though I did not like misbehaving or lying, I did feel an odd kind of pride in how quick you were to take the blame on behalf of your sisters. After having put your loyalty to each other to the test and finding your love for one another exceeded any punishment I might exact, I would watch you three relax, become chattier and begin joking with one another, thinking you had fooled me. But of course, I could not tell Hadia how disappointed I was. She had done what was right. But we had tried our best to teach her, to be honest, to respect the laws of the home, the classroom, and eventually the greater world. And once she knew that I knew, I could not pretend that all was well. You had betrayed me and our agreement. You had made a fool out of me, and the more I thought about it, the angrier I became.
Before going to Hajj, a Mormon must repay the debts owed, draft a will, and ask for forgiveness from friends and loved ones. Practically, I imagine, because the Hajj is taxing and possibly dangerous, and partially because one then comes back a sinless man, and meeting those conditions might be prerequisites for cleansing one's life. The older I get, the easier it is for me to imagine that God can forgive a man for his sins when they only affect him. But maybe he wants people to mend any hurt and harm they cause their fellow brothers and sisters while in this life, while living in this realm. Layla and I went to Hajj the first year we were married. I wanted to show her that though she had left her whole life behind, I would care for her spiritual needs as well as any other. In those first months we were together, we were very careful and kind with one another, and I wondered if an environment as unfamiliar and challenging as Hajj would bring us together in a new and unpredictable way. I was still young. I had very little debt. I paid for my co-worker's lunch as he had once paid for mine. I returned my library books. I paid rent for our small apartment in advance so the debt would not be incurred while we were away. I called my uncle, who had cared for me after my parents' passing, my mother's brother, who I had not known very well during their life, but who, after their death, I thought of as an older brother. I asked him if there was anything I owed him.
"You know there is nothing. Anything I did for you, you have repaid me in full."
"Is there anything I should ask forgiveness for?"
"There is nothing."
Layla and I went. The Kaaba was a cube of bricks covered by a black cloth, a simple design, and yet when I looked upon it for the first time, it was bigger than I ever imagined it, and the sea of bodies dressed in white moved around it in 1,000 tiny and synchronized motions, and my breath, as they say, was taken from me. We were one with the wave of people that circled and circled the Kaaba. I touched the crack in the corner where they say the Kaaba split open for Imam Ali's mother to enter, so she could give birth to him inside. I touched the black stone surrounded by people also desperate to touch it. Standing still in that rush was manageable one moment, and the next my body was caught in a current of bodies, 12 crushing in on all sides, all of us moving the inexplicable way a body of water moves, so that when I was spat from it, I emerged, gasping. If separated, Layla and I would meet at our designated spot and try again to enter. For the first time, I experienced the power of spotting the face one loves in a crowd. How of all the faces that passed me, hers was the one that was capable of shocking my senses the moment I first found her. I led her to the stone. I held steady my arms around her and stood there like a dam, so she could touch the stone as well. Exhausted and in a dreamlike state, we slept and we woke, wore white, ate bread and a kind of crumbly and sharp cheese we had not tasted in either India or America, almonds and cashews. I shaved my head, and we were born again, sinless as when we had begun our lives on earth. In the evenings now I take my daily walk, often accompanied by Layla. We are quiet together. She walks with her hands in front of her, and I with mine clasped behind me. She pays attention to the shrubbery and the flowers in people's gardens. I think of what I could do to best prepare for the next realm. I think of the debts I owe, my will, who I have wronged, my debts, my will, my need for forgiveness. I was there both nights my grandchildren were born. Layla and Tariq were in the room with Hadia, and I was relieved to pace the hall, never going far, ready to be called in at any moment and do what Hadia had asked me to, deliver the adhan to my grandchild. I was honored. The first time I practiced the adhan, nervous that I had forgotten it, an absurd fear as I had recited it multiple times a day for years. Then the nurse came. "She is ready for you," she said. That was my first child in the hospital room, cradling her first child. It was a miracle if I ever witnessed one. She held the baby, and I did not know if the baby was a boy or a girl, and nothing mattered but that everyone was alive and here together. Hadia passed her child to me as soon as I approached her. The baby was smaller than I remembered my children being, and so light it took me a moment to realize I was the only one holding on to the child.
"His name is Abbas, Baba," she said, and I could not even see his face because my eyesight had blurred, the lights of the room caught in big, gorgeous circles that shifted as I blinked. I lifted Abbas to my face,
His ear was so delicate and red it reminded me of a tiny shell. And I whispered the adhan, essentially saying, "Welcome to the world, my little one. Here, we believe in one God. Muhammad is his messenger. Ali is his friend. And I will do my best to tell you all about it." In seventh grade, you played soccer for your middle school, and I often came home to your duffel bag of cleats and crumpled shorts and jersey in the foyer. I would open the door and yell until you came downstairs. Yell while you rolled your eyes at me and picked the bag up. Yell after you to not slam the doors, and you would open the door and slam it again and again and again. Your face blank each time you opened it. And I'd have to turn around and walk straight into the street, just to keep from acting in a way I would surely regret. Did you know that for years, your mother never uttered a word against me unless it was in defense of you? I would return to our bedroom shaking, still angry from having dealt with you, either your batamizi or your usage of bad language or getting suspended after another fight at your school. I would take a seat at the edge of my bed and rest my head in my hands and try to calm myself. I let my anger get too carried away, I told myself. I should have stopped before I did what I did. Anger was my worst attribute. It was as if I left myself when it shot up in me, and by the time I was rid of it, I had already done the damage. And even though I could justify why I had reacted the way I had, I always regretted my particular reaction. And Layla would be absolutely silent around me. She would not even be aware that she too had withdrawn from me. The year that you tried playing soccer, the year that your duffel bag was always in the foyer and you listened to music that sounded as angry as you were, your grandfather had a heart attack. We did not know then that he would only have a few more months to live, and your mother left to visit him in India. That very week, I came home to the sound of the TV blasting through the halls and your duffel bag right where I predicted it would be. I remember I did not even yell. I swung it over my shoulder and walked into the street and shook the bag until its contents tumbled out. Your water bottle, your jersey, your cleats, which I kicked until they landed feet away in different directions. Your books and notebooks, their pages fluttering in the street. And I stormed back inside, yelling your name. I grabbed you by the ear and dragged you out the front door and shoved you until you stumbled onto the driveway. And I pointed at your papers torn and flying away and your clothes and contents strewn about. And we watched the passing cars do little to avoid them. You did not speak to me after that. I couldn't really blame you. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw your belongings scattered on the road. I saw the redness of your ear when I finally released it. Would you believe me if I told you I hated myself more in those moments than I imagined you hated me? My pride bothered me. It was my own self I had to overcome. I could not even go to you, say to you that I was sorry, that I had overreacted. The Twin Towers fell the next morning. You still did not speak to me. I did not think of how you might be affected. You were a boy. I did not have to worry about you the way I worried about the safety of my daughters, both of them wearing hijabs. Layla was so far away. I was so alone. I was not sure what the world outside was like, when it would regain a shape I knew, if my family would be safe inside it. When my phone rang at work that week, I feared the worst. Maybe my father-in-law had passed away,
Maybe Leila had been told she could not book her ticket home for even longer.
But it was your school nurse telling me that you had been in a fight, that you were hurt as well as suspended. My desk was decorated the same as always. Your little red boat on the blue waves, still there, just the edges of it curled a bit. Each wave was distinguished from the others. I sighed into the phone. You had been in fights before. You had been suspended before. But they had never told me that you were hurt.
Is he all right? I asked her. He will be, she said, but he might need stitches.
I was quiet for a while. The nurse, bless her, did not hang up. She told me that the scuffle had taken place in the locker room after PE class, that a few other boys had been involved and all of them were suspended. And while she talked, I wondered how I would ever explain this to your mother, who called me every night worried after watching the news, the same footage looping and the smoke billowing in the air, asking me to reassure her that everything at home was calm. I decided I would just not tell her. I calculated the days that remained until her return and hoped it would be enough for any evidence to heal.
Sir?
The nurse asked me, dropping her tone into a serious whisper.
May I offer my honest opinion?
Yes, of course.
Between you and me, it wasn't your son's fault. I think the other boys were being awful and cruel. I think they instigated it.
She did not know you as I knew you. How it likely had been your fault. You might be in her office giving her the look you give your mother, your eyes very big and dramatically sad and inspiring compassion.
Still, I asked,
they were being cruel?
Racist, sir.
Something in me snapped, or sank, I'm not sure what it was. I told my boss I was leaving to pick you up. He's hurt, I said, stitches. Anger had always been my response to your antics. And here was another suspension, another fight. But as I drove to your school, I was surprised to find that I swelled with a panicked kind of love for you. Your mother was not there beside me, ready to be the one who pulled you into her arms, ready to tell you of course it was not your fault, of course she was not mad. Layla's love and affection for you expanded so palpably, so without complexity and doubt, that what I felt for you felt small in comparison, as though there were no room for me to have my own love, my own affection, and my need to respond to you another way to give you balance became all the more necessary. I went to the office and said who I was. Whose father I was. I signed my shaky signature on a clipboard, and I was not ashamed. I was restless as I touched my eyebrow, looked about the office, and noticed your old friend, the boy, Mark, sitting there, an ice pack held to his nose, his eyes wide and afraid when they met mine. At first, I was so surprised to recognize him that I lifted my hand to wave. Mark was frozen and expressionless in response, except for the ice pack that crunched as he pressed it against his face. And then I knew. The nurse said she would go back to the sick room to call you, and I told her I would wait in the car. For some reason, I did not want you to know that I had seen Mark. I did not know if I should say goodbye to Mark and send my regards to his parents, whom I had gotten to know, or if I should ask him what had happened, and so I did nothing. I said nothing. I sat in my car, I tapped my fingers on the steering wheel. I turned on the car and switched on the radio, moving slowly between stations so that the car filled with static
and then words, and then static, and then music, and then static again.
At last you appeared. I may have imagined a slight limp as you approached me.
You walked, staring at your feet.
I watched from the open window, taking inventory. A swollen left eye, a tear in your lip, blood dried on your shirt. And I don't think I ever loved you more than when you opened the car door and I confirmed your injuries up close. You did not meet my eyes. You quickly buckled your seatbelt and sank into your seat and turned to look out the window the way you would when you were a toddler and I was driving you to the barber's. I began to drive. I thought of your silence, trying to understand it, to know when and how it would be appropriate to break it.
Were you embarrassed? Were you ashamed?
Were you afraid I would raise my voice?
After the last suspension and the school fight, we had made it very clear it could never happen again.
Your mother had begged you to be better. I wanted to reassure you that I was not thinking of those times, or if I was, I was not mad about the fight. I had never enjoyed meeting another's eyes. I have always preferred to look elsewhere when engaged in conversation. But on that drive, I tried to look, and I waited for you to look back, but you did not.
We drove down the street I loved, and it was autumn, so the leaves were reds and yellows and slowly fluttering to the ground.
What was it you wanted from me? I wondered. Did you want me to ask why it had happened?
You were the kind of quiet that one has to make a decision to uphold. We had not spoken since the incident with your duffel bag.
I had made a mistake. Why could I not be like your mother, who could reach over and touch your arm?
Why was it that before I was about to interact with you, I felt a grand growing desire to approach you in one way,
generously, affectionately?
But the moment I encountered you in your body, I paused, stopped. My own uncertainty, my own stubbornness, making it impossible for me to approach you the way that I wanted to.
I turned on the radio again and tuned it to a new station and let another voice fill the air, and you groaned and crumpled in your seat a little lower, as if that had been the wrong gesture. And I had again disappointed you.
You haven't left your bag in the foyer for days, I said,
almost cheerfully and softly, when the car slowed to a stop at a red light, thinking of the first thing that came to me that was not connected to the swelling of your face. I wanted to acknowledge that I appreciated you remembering to put the bag away. I wanted to normalize the situation. I wanted to say something mundane so as to tell you, look, we can carry on. I am not mad. This and everything else is behind us. And you looked at me then, the stoniest look I had ever seen. And you held my gaze until I felt chills. And you said, I really hate you. Not in the way you usually said it, in a moment of anger and frustration, and therefore easily dismissed, but calmly and evenly. And then the light turned green, and the car behind me honked, and I turned back to the road and continued driving.
Weeks after the fight between you and the other boys, you ran after me as I approached the edge of the street. I was taking a long walk before driving an hour to pick up Layla from the airport. She was finally coming home. I was nervous. I did not know if they would bother her in arrivals, if she would be able to manage the questions without me, if they would treat her roughly. In the sunlight, I studied your face as you walked beside me. Your lip had healed well, but there would be a scar. The swelling around your eye had gone away, but there would also be a scar there that flicked through your eyebrow. "I want to ask you something," you said. I stopped to listen, but you kept walking, so I followed. You took a right at the road that would take us to the horses. You were taking a long time to ask me. "Can you shave your beard?" you said. You were looking at your shoes, then at me for just a moment, then at your shoes again, as your feet picked up the pace. "Why?" I asked, though I was afraid I knew. "You made Hadia and Huda take off their scarves." My daughters had not pointed out the hypocrisy of my act, of wanting to follow my faith, but wanting them to be safe more. But of course, you had. "Why can't you change for us? You make them change for you."
"Watch your tone,"
I said, because I could not come up with anything else to say. You kicked a pine cone, and it skittered down the street. You were on a mission. You would not retreat. You wanted a persuasive answer from me. "Baba," you said, and I was crushed. Even then, you had stopped calling me Baba. You somersaulted through your sentences to avoid calling me Baba, and thought I was dumb enough to not realize. "If you shave, you won't look like..." You paused, considered your words, then said quietly, "The bad guys." It pained me. It was such childish wording. But you could not allow yourself to say anything else. I did not know then, as Hadia knows now, how to be a parent in the face of all this, how to turn the TV off, how to speak to Abbas and Tahira about what they did not deserve to think or hear from the kids in school, even if we could not protect them from hearing it. She reminds them again and again that what might happen in the world and what they might overhear cannot reach or alter what is within them, their hearts, their future. We did none of this. It is not that we thought our way was better, it was that we did not know another way. "But I am not the bad guys," I said. We had reached the horses. You perked up a bit to see them. "I know that," you said in your matter-of-fact voice, "but they don't." One horse trotted to approach us. You stretched out your hand. I did not ask who they were. "Amar, those boys you fought, did they say anything about the bad guys?"
"No."
You pushed your tongue against your cheek. You were lying. We turned to go back. My hands were in my pockets, and your hands were in your pockets. "So will you?" you asked me. "I can trim it," I said. That was one of the first times I thought about it in that way. That there was a they. People who assumed something about me. My family. There were enough troubling interactions in the years to come to know that they were there. But back then, I thought of it as isolated incident after isolated incident, and not a force that tied each one, brewing with each year that passed. They stared at my wife a little too long in the park, and I could not help but wonder if it was because of her hijab, or if there was a darker reason. And so I locked eyes right back, and I nodded. And I did my best to smile. "Hello,"
I might say to anyone we came across in passing, just in case they felt it, fear or anger, each emotion feeding the other like a loop.